Chapter 7, Content and Context. In this chapter, I talk about thinking like a supermarket, the truth about automating, building trust on Twitter, and bartering your way to the next big level. People buy with their hearts, not their heads. And the way to every consumer's heart is through a good story. The Greeks recited their stories. The medieval bards sang theirs. And then the printing press dominated for more than 500 years. Less than a century ago, we started putting out a lot of stories on radio and television. Today, we tweet and blog and Instagram. But even as the platforms and distribution channels change, the rules of good storytelling have remained the same for businesses since the beginning of commerce. The quality of a brand's storytelling is directly proportional to the quality of its content. If it's not good, no one will pay attention. What defines quality content nowadays? A. It appeals to the heart. B. It's shareable. C. It's native to the platform on which it appears. D. It breaks through the noise. I find the last one ironic. Not very long ago, it was only big brands that had the muscle to blast their story all over the radio, newspapers, magazines, and television. Today's marketer, however, doesn't have to invest in a printing press or a satellite or buy expensive advertising. You don't even necessarily need a sales team in order to distribute your story anymore. You're so lucky to have access to the internet and to be able to use its tools to put out your content. Unfortunately, everyone else has them too. That low bar of entry means that the field is ridiculously crowded, and it's getting harder and harder to get noticed. Which is why it's so vitally important that everyone from big organizations to solo entrepreneurs to small companies start thinking and acting like media companies. Sure, you're selling liquor or tech or original art, but the very survival of your company will depend on distributing your story through your content as often as possible to as many people as possible. And not just any content, but content that brings value to your current customers while attracting new customers as well. Netflix gets it. That's why they started making their own TV series. So does Starbucks, which is developing original documentaries that tie into themes relevant to socially conscious brands. Red Bull, too, is producing original videos, articles, and news covering sports, lifestyle, and culture. If you're not putting out good content on a regular basis, you'll be drowned out by the companies that are. You will be Blockbuster Video. You will be Borders Bookstore. You will be the carriage driver who bought a lot of horses just as the first Model T drove off the lot. This advice goes to individuals, too. Like it or not, unless you're living completely off the grid, you've got an online identity. And everybody, from dates to schools to employers, will rely on the internet to see what they can learn about you before ever meeting you in the first place. It's in your best interest to shape what they see. If you're not producing content, you don't exist. It takes far more time than money, so for a while, you might have to allocate your time differently than you might have been taught back in B school. Staffing, strategizing, and selling are important. But if you must, take a few hours away from those operations every day and put that time towards creating content. That's how you scale the unscalable. You don't have to have $1 billion like Starbucks or Red Bull to become your own media company. All you have to do is put the time in and be aware of emerging social networks. That's how I got my start. I didn't have millions of dollars to get Wine Library's story out there. I distributed my content on these weird new platforms called Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. They were free, they were easy to use, and no one else there was doing what I was doing, which meant my content got noticed. Now you've got Instagram and Snapchat, Medium and Meerkat, and many, many more. Mold your content so it feels native to these platforms and creates context. Scratching the emotional itch that drew your customer to the platform in the first place. Meanwhile, keep your eyes open to the new up-and-comers. Take advantage of the platforms no one else is using. Make them work for you. People and brands are using content and context to become stars on them every day.
Hey guys, it's Chase Jarvis. I'm a photographer and the CEO of Creative Live, which is the world's largest online learning platform for creative skills and for entrepreneurship. My pal Gary Vee asked me to read the next questions for the Ask Gary Vee book, so here we go. Can anyone create good micro content? How can you make sure your team consistently creates good content?
Short answer is yes, but it's a very long answer. First and foremost, it starts with a very important word, and that's called respect. There's two things that you're going to have to respect to deliver on this. Number one is the platforms themselves, Snapchat, Instagram, Pinterest, Twitter. The second is the audience, the people that are on it. Let's break that down. Let's start with the platform. The platforms are different. My friends, the platforms are different. You can't make a video or a picture and then think about Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat as the place you just distribute them, because this is where the audience comes in. Let's use Sally. She's 44 years old with two kids. She lives in Manhattan. You want to sell to her because you're selling toys to six-year-olds and you want to attract moms that can afford it. And she lives in Manhattan, so she's got a couple bucks, right? Let's think about her when she's on Facebook. When she opens her phone on the way to work and opens up Facebook, she's trying to keep up with her world. She's following some of the brands, some of the news outlets, and most importantly, some of her friends that she most cares about. And her newsfeed is littered with information on their friend's vacation, right? Or a brand that's trying to sell her something. So she's in the psychology of keeping up with her world. Let's say when she's done with that 16 minutes later, she opens up Pinterest on her phone. When she goes there, she's in a totally different mindset. She's there for shopping or aspiration or inspiration to redecorate her room or where she wants to vacation this summer. Now think about you trying to sell a $15 board game to her. Don't you think that you have to put different content on Pinterest than Facebook, even though she's still 44-year-old Sally with two kids from Manhattan? Absolutely. Think about yourself right now, the way you act in a business meeting with your boss versus you going to Vegas with your boys for a weekend. You're the same guy. You're still 27-year-old Charlie. But Charlie, let's admit it, you're a totally different dude when you're at the Spearmint Rhino with Rick at 3 a.m. than when you're in with your boss John trying to pitch that sale. And so we have to respect both. You have to understand how the platforms work, what works on them. Pinterest, infographics work, right? On Instagram, inspirational quotes work. And so maybe it's the inspiration of what a board game can do for a kid. I'm painting you a very clear picture of what matters. And by the way, if you're fascinated by what I just talked about, which I kind of even was weirdly fascinated by the way I just did that, and that is a humble brag, that's what I focused on in Jab, 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 Right Hook, really breaking down that science. That's why it was a textbook. There's a second part to this question, which is consistency. This comes down to the two T's, team and time, right? How much time are you putting in to learn what other people are doing or what you're doing on these platforms and what's resonating with you or other people? Or how much time are you actually spending in making content? Today, I make a lot more content than I used to because I'm putting in the time. But I also built a team. So for a lot of you that are listening, and this answer was probably the one that was best for brand managers of CPG clients or CMOs or marketers of big companies, you know, you got to think about time. And then you got to think about the team, right? Are you putting your team in a position to succeed? Are you allowing them to actually do this? Are you educated enough to know how to judge them? And more importantly, are you giving them the resources? Are you giving enough money to make these videos and pictures so they can make six of them for six different platforms instead of one of them that they then distribute across all the platforms? The two T's and the two real pillars, the platforms and the audience.
Let's say you owned a hockey team. What would you do with Snapchat?
I love this. So first of all, if I owned a hockey team, hopefully it'd be the New York Rangers. Let's start with that. I would understand that what Snapchat offers me right now, this recording, early 2016, is enormous opportunity to win the heart and minds of 13 to 30-year-olds in America and really shape the minds of 13 to 18-year-olds. And so what I would do is I would take a step back and say, cool, I know what the Rangers stand for. I know what I want people to think about the Rangers. But the problem is you can't talk to a 16-year-old about the Rangers the same way you're going to talk to a 42-year-old. And so I would try to think about what's the cross-section of relevancy, right? For example, I would create contests on our Snapchat stories about date night for high school kids, right?
High school kids care about dating. That's kind of cool. And so having great seats against the glass to impress that girl that you've been chasing your whole life and finally she's giving you a date, that's cool. That's a quick way to go viral in Westchester amongst potential New York Ranger fans. So I would go back to what I just talked about. First, I would think about the audience and their psychology on Snapchat. They like silly things. It's fun. I would not overproduce content. I think one of the biggest mistakes right now brands and individuals are doing is they're trying to make their Snapchat content too fancy. Too good of lighting. This is not a Hollywood blockbuster. People want quick, raw talent. You know, just quick. I would take a video of Henrik Lundqvist, but the lighting was bad. You could kind of not even make out King Henry. Like, you know, I would make it very authentic and real, and I would use it as if I was a 16-year-old boy, but that would be the Rangers account. And then I would entice them with, if they watch the story to the end, to get that full engagement, there was ways to enter contests that brought them value. So I would treat the platform the way it's supposed to be treated, and then I would create incentives around the psychology of that audience based on things that I could bring them value. And to me, the dating culture is kind of neat. So there you go.
Hey guys, this is Thiago Moraes, founder and CEO of Galloper and VacoVet. And here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. What are your thoughts on the new TLD extensions market? We have seen some new extensions sold for a good money, like DUI.attorney. Is this going to take off as people expect? Is this something that VaynerMedia would bet on? Thank you.
Let me go very tactical here. This is not something VaynerMedia is going to invest in. I don't think that many people think it's going to take off. I have a feeling, Doctor, you're probably a domainer or somebody in that space within that ecosystem. I think the people that bought a lot of these want to think it's going to take off because they want to make the market. Let me ground this into what TLDs are. They're top level domains. What that means is, you know how you go to .com and then there's also .net and things of that nature. For a long time, there was just only, you know, two handfuls of dot somethings that we could do. They're opening up the whole thing. So people were able to go out and buy and own dot wine, dot Vaynerchuk, dot water. And now everybody's curious if there's going to be a marketplace. My intuition is there's not going to be. I believe that over the last 20 years that .com has become a brand, kind of a stamp of approval, kind of the standard. And of course, I'm aware of .co becoming a cool thing in the tech world and .net having some respect and things of that nature. But my intuition is that there's so much supply when you open up every word to a dot that all of it gets diluted and it's just supply and demand. And so to me, I don't see it taking off. I'm not bullish on it. Let's say this happened 5 years ago and somebody bought dot selfie and then selfies became the biggest thing. And then some Kodak tries to make a comeback and thinks that dot selfie is their strategy and could pay $1 million for it. Do I think there's a couple of real huge wins? I absolutely do. I think when you net score the whole thing out, I think the market's going to be soft and a lot of people are going to lose money.
Everyone visiting my site is coming there for custom music. Should I delay them with other content?
You know, that question is inherently poor for me because I think it alludes to, and I'm sure everybody will agree, it alludes to you trying to extract value out of them versus the other way around. And so it paints a picture of a short game versus the long game, meaning what I assume you're asking is you'd like them to stay a little bit longer because either you're selling advertising or you'd like them to become aware of your shop or whatever you are. I don't think you're a bad guy or gal for asking that. I just think that it speaks to you're not thinking about it for the longest term and you're looking for a short-term transaction. I'd like to switch your mindset. I'd like you to think about a supermarket, right? So supermarkets, if you think about how they're laid out, they have the essentials on the opposite sides, right? They try to make you go as far as possible to milk because almost everybody coming in there is going to buy milk. Now, they don't block it. You know, they may make it kind of inconvenient. And so I would say there's a very fine line on a website from a UI UX, the layout of your site. Are you going to do a 4 pop-ups before they get to what they want? You know, you're going to lose them by pop-up number 2. There's a way to find that perfect Mendoza line between value for you and value for them. The other thing you should do, in my opinion, is you should build up a lot of equity first, meaning I highly recommend that you're thankful for them coming in the first place. There's a lot of places for custom music. And so I would occasionally come out with some hardcore right hooks. Maybe you do a pop-up email collection thing for a week or something of that nature and take it away. But to really make it hard, I think would be a mistake. And I'm not sure that's your energy either. I can see how, you know, depending on how this was asked in your brain. But please, everybody listening, the reason I'm giving a broad answer is I want to bring value to all of you. Understand that you've got to give a little bit more value to the consumer than for yourself. And if you can just find that balance, you will win. And so think about that supermarket thing. They're not making you go to a second floor or out the back door to get to the milk. It's just a little further away so you see everything else.
What's the best way to grow a following or grow a community from nothing?
Let's start with this. Whatever you're talking about, you have to be good at it. Meaning if you want to build a community about being a great photographer, you yourself have to be a great photographer. Wine, sports, whatever it may be, you need to make sure that you're putting out quality content and a lot of it. Please understand, my friends, nobody has a million followers on any of these platforms by accident. Either they are massively attractive, and so they're replicating something that happened in the past, which is called modeling. Like, people have been famous and have been successful for being gorgeous for a very, very long time. Or they're me, right? I'd like to think I'm gorgeous, but I think that's I don't think I've won that game as at the level I think I deserve, by the way, as a side note. But where I've won is I had something of quality to talk about in two genres now, right? In the wine business, in the wine world, and now in business. And so I think, first and foremost, the only way you'll build a community is if you have something to say that enough people want to hear or something to show that enough people want to see. Next, it's about consistency and work ethic. You've got to really go out and do it every day, day in and day out. If you're winning on looks and you're only putting up a picture on Instagram once every 7 days, the same pretty girl or pretty guy that's doing it 4 times a day is probably going to amass more of a community than you. Now let's get into tactics. First and foremost, I'm a huge fan of guest blogging. Sit down, spend a week, that's right, not a day, a week mapping every blog that is important and every media outlet that's important in your world. And I would extend that to Instagram profiles that have audiences. Find out all the people that have attention already and figure out how you can go and reach out and do things. I like blogs because blogs are always looking for writers. So if you're able to write around your subject matter, which you may not, and I'll get to that in a minute, reach out to the blogs and say, hey, listen, I'd like to talk about photography in the Pacific Northwest, and I like your photography blog. Would you like me to guest blog? You'd be stunned how many people say yes because they're looking for content because there's a need. There's so many sites out there. And all of a sudden, you write a great piece of content, and your byline is linked to your profile, and now 8 people read it. Yes, I said 8. This doesn't happen overnight. This happens over years and years and years and years. But 8 people would read it. Now 4 of those people clicked on your thing, and now, you know, 2 of them are following you, and you rinse and repeat, and you rinse and repeat, and you rinse and repeat. And that's just blogging. You go out and find a Snapchat photographer and say, can I take over your channel for a day or two? And I'll guest story for you, because I guess that's going to be the term we're going to call it. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to siphon audience from other people while bringing that person value. You can't just come to me and say, Gary, can I be on the Ask Gary Vee show? No. I mean, everybody, 500 people, but if you've brought me value, like Lewis Howes or Chase Jarvis in the past, that gives you, you know, or if I don't know you, but you're going to say, I can do this on your show, and I decide that's good for my audience, then the answer is yes. And so, I think that's probably the biggest North Star. You've got to put out great content consistently. You've got to find other places that have audiences that can give you exposure. HARO, H-A-R-O, Help a Reporter Out. Used to be a newsletter that was out for a long time. I don't know what's going on with it these days, and it may still exist, where literally it was an email that went out every day and had hundreds of reporters that were looking for certain stories, and you were able to just email them and say, hey, I'm a boy who likes the New York Jets. And so there's always people looking for content. You just have to be willing to give it. Even when you're not a known entity, you still can have those at-bats. Too many people are struggling with this issue because they think they have to be somebody to give an opinion. Unfortunately, I guess at some level, anybody can give an opinion about anything at this point. And so if you have your subject matter down, You've got to equally put out content on all the platforms, blog, Medium, Facebook, Twitter, and then you have to find audiences that already exist. Facebook groups, meetup.com, bulletin boards, social media influencers, and on and on and on. And you've got to become part of that community. You've got to go in for asks. Don't forget Wayne Corbett. You're going to get 97 blogs that say no, and then you get one that says, yes, you can guest blog. And then this is how it works. It's so amazing, guys. 97 no's, and you did it from 8 p.m. to 2 in the morning because you have a full-time job and you want to get this going, and you're down. You're like, God damn it, Gary, I listened to you and you told me this and nobody's answered. But then that 104th time, one person says yes. Now, it's not even that big. You know, it's photographerdaily.com. It's an average site, but they said yes. This is where the content matters. If you write a really great piece of content, even though it's a small audience, an editor of a photography magazine reads it, right? She thinks it's amazing. She shares it on Twitter. Now all of a sudden more people see it. And you see where I'm going? It's a match. It's a domino. But that same editor can come on and say, that's a boring piece, and stop reading after three. Now the quality of your content didn't create your opportunity. The system works. It's worked time and time again. You just have to make sure that you're A, talented enough in your subject matter, and B, putting enough work to keep getting those at-bats. Now, like I referenced earlier, if you can't write, maybe it's audio. Maybe you do a podcast. Maybe you show up on people's podcasts. Maybe you're great on camera. That was my thing, right? Like, I didn't know, but it happened. So maybe that's your route. Maybe you draw cartoons. I mean, I'm not joking. Maybe you draw, and all of a sudden, who would have ever thought you make $100,000 a year making photography cartoons for different photography media outlets? You just never know until you try. And I was 30 years old, super self-aware, successful already, and I had no idea that I had a personal brand in me. And I was a big boy. I was 30. So, like, you never, ever know until you try.
The company I'm working for has a great story, but we're not getting the engagement we hoped we would. Is it worthwhile for us to promote our Facebook posts, tweets, and LinkedIn posts in order to gain more engagement from our social posts?
So to clear up any confusion, the word promote here is really referring to, should we run any advertising dollars to get more people to see it? So, you know, it's, you post something on Facebook, you've got a small community, you know your story's great, like this company believes it is, but you've just got a small base, so should we spend $100 on a post to get 10 more thousand people to see it? The short answer is yes. The next answer is more interesting, which is, who decides that you have a great story? You know, it's back to me earlier claiming I was so good looking, right? Like, everybody thinks their kids are the best looking kids in the world. It's just the way it is. So the answer is yes for twofold. Yes, because if it is great, if you got the money, it gives you a spark to get distribution, and that may start your process. On the other side, if you spend a lot of money and you still see nobody, like, again, I'm going to use photographers, I'll just stick with it. You're trying to reach photographers, you target photographers. On Facebook, you can do that. You can target interests or organizations, and you still don't see the results. Now you get to take a step back and say, wait a minute, maybe our story isn't that good. So either way you win. By spending $500 on a post to really amp it up, you either are going to start the process to victory or expose why you're losing. If you're losing, this gives you an opportunity to kind of change up the content and the context of your creative, and really can set you to a path of success. So, and by the way, spending $20 to amplify and run an ad on Facebook is worthwhile for just impressions. I don't know if it's going to lead to the most business, but it'll give you an indication if you're going down the right path. As a matter of fact, taking a real step back, if you can afford spending $20, $30 on advertising every piece of content you put out on Facebook, I would do it, because you're going to learn something. Plus, you can target men, you can target African-American females, you can target African-American females that live in Atlanta, you can target, you know, moms with this income level, that, you know, you can target employees of IBM, you can target fans of NASA. I mean, the data is incredible.
What's better for content, blogging or vlogging?
Both, but it comes really down to what are you best at, right? So is it written word? Or is it video blogging? I mean, to me, vlogging's better because I'm better on video. I'm more capable. Even my writing for blogging now is done by a third person. You know, I need that support. This book, you know, I need a ghostwriter. That's just the way I communicate. So you have to reverse engineer who you actually are at talent-wise. I think anybody who thinks or claims that they're both good at writing or video content should do both and see where they're getting more traction. or really do both for 3 or 4 months and then decide which one they think they have more upside in and then shift it 80-20 or 100-0. Maybe you ended up being scared of the camera.
I have 39,000 Instagram followers and I average about 250 likes per photo. I also run the Instagram account for the company I work for and we have 6,000 followers and also get 250 likes per photo. What am I doing wrong on my personal account that I don't get so many likes?
This happens all the time. How many followers you have is not an indication to how many people adore you or love you or going to buy from you. They're just how many people considered to adore you, love you, and buy from you. And so it sounds like your company's doing a better job putting out content that is relevant to their audience than you are. But I also recall that when I look deeper into this on the show, you happen to have a name that was a generic name on Instagram. I remember it being like Instagram/Alex or Rick or something of that nature. So I have a funny feeling a lot of people just follow you because you have an average name of an average guy. And so you have a lot of followers who actually don't give a crap of you. They probably were just following to see who you were or how'd you get that name or things of that nature. I'm giving that for context for everybody who's listening. The real answer was the first part, which is the width of your audience has nothing to do with the depth of your audience, right? When you think of Kiss, the band, they don't have the biggest fan base in the world, but why are they still around? Because the people that love Kiss will see them 17 times. And so you think of the Rolling Stones or Fish or the Grateful Dead, you have these kind of cultural phenomenons where they're only based on depth. It has nothing to do with width. And so width can come when you're a boy band and for 4 years, everybody in the world knows you, but then they go away. And those are the differences. And that happens every day with individuals, businesses, and social media accounts. And that's why I am very excited about how I go about building my communities because I don't have the biggest numbers in the world. But the reason my books sell better, the reason my businesses do better is because the ones I have actually care so much. I provide so much value that they tend to come back and do the things that I'm looking for in return. The other thing to note is on Twitter, on Snapchat, on some of these platforms, I'll get better engagement because I myself am actually using them better than I'm using some of the other platforms. So one of the things that people have to keep in mind is you might just be built to be great on Instagram because you have a photographer's eye and you're more interesting there, but you're not witty enough or giving good information on Twitter to win there. So there's the platform behaviors and your skill to matching that that are also a variable that creates an outcome of how much engagement you have versus the top line following count.
Should I post articles on my blog and just mention them on social? Or should I post natively to sites like LinkedIn, Facebook, or Medium?
So the answer is, it depends on what you're trying to achieve. So if you have a blog where the number one reason you have your blog is not to build your brand and build awareness, but it's to convert people into a product or service and or to monetize advertising on impressions on your blog, well, then you may want to use social networks to drive them there. Though I think if you're going to use it just for distribution, you've heard from me for the last 4 years that that's not totally going to work. Though if you get a small percentage of your audience and that's your only KPI and that's what you really want to happen, then good for you and then that's fine. I think what you should be doing is doing both, right? You're more than welcome to use it as a distribution to drive there, but you should also be posting these things natively on these platforms because people don't want to click and go somewhere else. Their time is what's valuable, and you want to impact them and affect them in the channels that they actually are. Creating any friction or stealing any time away from an individual is a bad thing. Plus, in a world of pop-up ads and all these other things, people are just fatigued from clicking and clicking and clicking. So if you actually just want to get your message out, well, then I would do both. You put them everywhere natively and let people consume where they want to be.
What do you think of the recent Omnicom advice to move 25% of ad budgets to online video and that space in general?
So, as a top line headline, I think it's phenomenal, and I agree. I mean, look, at the end of the day, if you are a human being in 2016 and you don't realize that more and more attention is going towards the mobile device and the platforms that are on it, well, then you just lack common sense or you're trying to hold on to a world that doesn't exist anymore. The concern I have with that, especially with big media companies like Omnicom, a lot of times that means pre-roll on YouTube videos, which means when somebody's going to see a cat fall out of the tree because they think it's funny or clever, and then you give them a 30-second car ad that I had no interest for, I think you're buying inventory that doesn't matter. And so it depends on what you do with that. If you're creating original pieces of content that are going to bring value to the audience because it's entertainment or escapism or utility, and you put that in a Facebook environment where you can actually target Jet fans that are 40 that drink wine, me, and then you put something that understands that that's me, and then the content is literally, you know, football players drinking wine, and it's like, buy Conchitoro from Chile. I'll be like, hey, good job, Conchitoro. I might call Wine Library and tell them to order more cases because that was a good execution. So I think that it's not a very deep statement. I think it's a lazy statement. And I don't blame Omnicom. I blame the people that have consumed the statement. I've heard this go around. I'm dealing with it. I think that people need to understand that mailing it in as pre-roll inventory, as when we go to ESPN.com and something pops up and takes over the whole goddamn site, and then it's a Fast and Furious 17 movie trailer, I'm not happy with that. That's not exciting me. You just stole 3 seconds from me. I'm just there to see who the Jets drafted, right? And so I think the execution of it matters as much as the statement of it. But clearly, movies and television are bigger than radio personalities and authors. Like, video rules our world. It's not confusing. Now we live on the internet, in our mobile device, virtual reality, masks and helmets and contact lenses. Video's gonna do really well there too. So I'm all in on video, but just because you spent $150 million to make The Last Action Hero doesn't mean you did something good. They lost a lot of money because the movie stunk. The content and how you deliver it matters most.
Short or long videos, what's the value?
The value is in what is being executed in the video. I mean, it's very simple. Let's break it down. Vine, 6-second max videos. I've seen incredible vines that have made me think. They've made me think. I've watched it 19 times in a row because it made me think. It made me laugh. I've also seen 3-hour movies that suck that I couldn't get through 16 minutes. Now on the flip side, if Star Wars 8 was 6.5 hours, I'd go see it, and I'd be pumped. I'd get nice and cozy, 2 bags of popcorn, and I wouldn't even, for a second, I wouldn't even daydream. But I've seen vines that are 6 seconds long, and they suck after 1 second. My friends, the length of the video is not the variable. The quality is. We are grossly underestimating. You know what Netflix has done for me? Finally allowed me to win the argument that I've had with my friends for a very long time, which is, how many of you right now, raise your hand if you sat and bin watched an entire season of a sitcom on Netflix? Yep, a lot of you. You know how good that makes me feel? You sat down on a Saturday at 7 a.m. with your boyfriend and you laid in bed the entire day and watched 11.5 hours of video because it was good enough. Oh, by the way, you started watching something else that Saturday morning and you stopped after 4 minutes because it wasn't good enough.
Hey, I'm Zach Moy, I'm Gary's designer, and let's get into the book. How do new and small channels gain a following when people don't engage?
Zach, first of all, you're an amazing, amazing talent. For everybody that doesn't know, Zach designed the cover of the Ask Gary Vee book, so thanks, Zach. Look, I think it comes down to business development and PR and sales. I think one of the things that have been a real challenge for a lot of people that make content on the internet and create channels, whether you're a platform as a channel like your Peach or Vine or Instagram or Snapchat in the beginning, or what I think this question is going towards, which is you've started a YouTube channel or an account at somewhere else, it's very hard. It's day one, right? You open up shop, nobody knows. And so a lot of you are artists, and putting out great content, and I've been talking about it the whole time here, is only part of it. My Netflix example, that's because Netflix actually created a channel where people go. But what about if you put that original series out on whohoohoohoohoohoo.com? Well, then nobody would ever find it. And even though you made the greatest sitcom of all time, because nobody ever saw it, it didn't become the greatest sitcom of all time. So one thing that is needed is distribution and awareness around something to give the first 15, and I said 15, 27, 99 people an opportunity to discover you. Now, let's get into tactics, right? One of my favorite moves is you have email, right? I mean, like, everybody here for the most part has an email. And so one of the things I like to do when I start something new is I change the signature on my email address to talk about it. So for example, probably in a week or so from the recording of this book, I'm going to change the bottom of my signature to not only say CEO of VaynerMedia, but I'm also going to say, check out my new book coming out March 8th, Ask Gary Vee, with a link to Amazon. I'm putting things in there that I want people to know. If you've started a channel about your pasta sauce, but you work at as an accountant somewhere, you may want to put at the bottom, P.S. I also am very passionate about food. Here's my YouTube channel. That's an easy way for every person you email every day to get a chance to build awareness. If it's engagement that you're worried about, well, then that may just come down to your content. If you've got 100 people watching a YouTube video and nobody commented and only one person liked it, it probably wasn't very good.
Hey, Gary, it's Timothy M. Evans, CEO of Athlete Web Design in Chicago. Really appreciate you selecting me as a book winner to be featured in the Ask Gary Vee book. As a marketer who works with pro athletes, I sometimes get players and agents questioning why an athlete needs a website. Gary, what would you say to a current pro athlete, retired athlete, or even an up-and-coming athlete who is getting scholarship offers who wants to brand themselves online? Should an athlete have an official website? If businesses are now considered media companies, should athletes be thinking along the same lines?
The answer is yes. What I would say to everybody is, look, I don't want to be at the vulnerability of just making my monies or have my opportunity just predicated on what I do on the field. You know, any of these guys stop playing football or baseball at 27, 29, 32, 34, and then have the rest of their lives ahead of them? By building a brand or a website, you're creating other ways for good things to happen for you because you don't want to put in the work because you've decided that you've quote unquote made it and you're going to just make your millions from playing sports. Sure. For the 1 to 2% of athletes that hit the biggest contracts in the world, I guess you can debate they don't want to, but do they want to actually do other things? Wouldn't an athlete that made $300 million maybe want to make a website to help the charities that he cares about? Maybe to put some of his friends on and give them exposure? There's only good that can come out of communication if you communicate well. And by not having a website, that athlete is basically not communicating to the world on their terms. What about all the athletes that hate the media because they spin every word? Wouldn't it be great to have your own website where you can actually talk to the world on your terms? Becoming a media company is powerful. Media controls the conversation. I'm stunned that there's a single agent that isn't giving that advice. It sounds like a sucky agent. And athletes, if you're paying attention, this is a way for you to do good for you.
This is Jack Haber. I'm the Vice President of Global Advertising at Colgate-Palmolive, and I'm very excited to be asking Gary some important questions. You say to put quality content out daily. Can I add curated content? And if so, what's the mix?
First and foremost, I think everybody will get a kick out of this. VaynerMedia does not do any business with Jack. I actually think Jack is a very talented marketer, and I've been fond of him. So, Jack, thanks for doing this, and I thought everybody get a kick out of that, so I wanted to say that. Anyway, of course you can. I think about curated content the way I think about DJs, right? They didn't create the song, but they mixed it in a way that brought value to the audience. As a matter of fact, if you follow music trends, DJs are becoming more famous than the actual songwriters. So I think you can absolutely be a curator. As a matter of fact, what is the evening news? Or SportsCenter. It's a curation of all the content that happened in the world that day. So I think curating content is an incredibly good idea. You look at Jason Hirschhorn's email newsletter, so many people follow it, Tech Meme, what Nuzzle the app does for me. These are incredibly powerful tools. Curation is very valuable because it's saving people time. I don't have to go and read every article to decide which 10 are the best. It's why Twitter works. It's how things bubble up. And it could be a mix. I would tell you that I do that very poorly. It makes me sad that I'm not curating more because I know it's valuable, but it takes a lot of time and effort to go through all that information to curate. And so if you get a balance of 80-20 or 20-80 or 10-90 or 90-10, find your cadence. For a lot of people, they're not capable of coming up with creative ideas or new thoughts. And what they're meant to do is be tremendous curators. Curators have always been great. And now that you can do both under one account, I think that's a great strategy. I'm devastated that I can't do it myself.
I work in two different spaces. How do I use social media platforms so that I'm not confusing my audience?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, this is interesting because I actually lived the life of doing both. I was the wine guy and the social media guy at the same time from 2009 to probably 2014. And I was carrying both. And I actually thought it was an advantage for me. I think one thing that we forget is that most humans are multidimensional. There's a lot of things we like. I think one of the biggest mistakes a lot of you are doing in your social networks right now is you don't talk about your love of root beer or that you're good at horseshoes or that you're on the dart team or that you love shopping. Like, you stay just in your lane and you're not letting people connect with you with other subject matters. On the flip side, it's actually very easy if you want to separate them, right? You can create separate Facebook fan pages. You can create separate Instagram accounts. With the phone, you can switch back and forth, sign in with one password, sign out. It's actually not complicated. I would argue, unless they're two very, very, very different things that you think hurt each other, unless you're like a Republican in one and a Democrat in another, or other, you know, or a Jets fan on one and a Patriots fan on another, as long as they're not completely crazy, I actually would push and urge many of you to mix them because I think it's a bigger 360 view of who you actually are.
Is there a way to drive traffic to a website when posting content directly to Facebook?
I never say that a question is stupid, so I won't do it now. But if there was ever a question that made absolutely no sense, and I'm so glad this question's in the book because it allows me to get pissed off and I like when I'm salty. A lot of you have been using the hashtag SaltyB. I'm salty here. Like, what kind of question? Yeah, the answer is yeah. Facebook is the biggest driver to website traffic on the internet now besides Google searching. I mean, not only is there a way, BuzzFeed and 100 other media companies built their entire businesses on the backbone of Facebook pushing traffic towards their website.
Should I wait until my website is 100% built before putting out content, or put out content while I'm still building it?
There's really two schools of thought here, and I think they're both right. Tommy Mottola, the legendary ex-president of Sony Music, once reached out to me, and he had a car pick me up, and I drove 4 hours up to upper Westchester. And, we had a very funny meeting. It was super fun for me. I was a young kid, and he said something interesting to me. He said, "Gary, never go on television until your record's out." What he was talking about was promoting, and he basically said a lot of my competition will put the star singer on TV 2 days before their album comes out, and the CD's not at the Virgin Megastore yet, and I think that's super stupid because people are at the height of their emotion and they run out and go and get at the store and it's not there yet. And it was a really interesting kind of story around striking when the iron's hot, making sure you do it when people are ready to consume it. And that would be the argument of, no, don't put out content yet because you have nowhere to drive them, and so you're losing out all those direct links to the website and da-da-da-da-da-da. On the flip side, there's a real argument to start building an audience towards that event, kind of the pre-hype and things of that nature. And Tommy was referring to a very old-school world of television driving you into Sam Goody's to buy a record, right? You know, in a world where now you can build an audience and a community on Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat, and then once you have it, siphon them to something. You look at DJ Khaled, who built a huge audience on Snapchat, and now he's sending them to his web store to sell his merchandise. I think both work. I understand both. And I think if you have time to do the content while you're building the website, I would do it. I would also say, if it's you building the website, put all your energy into getting the website done and then start it. So there was really no right or wrong way here. I just wanted to make sure I painted a picture for the audience that understood there's two ways to go about it, and you should be self-aware and decide which one works for you best. Are you the kind of person like me that likes to do multiple things at a time that keeps you going? Or are you the kind of like type A where like, okay, I'm gonna finish the website. Don't force yourself to do something that doesn't come natural to you.
Should I avoid doing podcasts or videos if I have a foreign accent?
I think that's crazy. Actually, it's not that crazy. Unfortunately, America has a funny bias to accents. We're very pro-America. I don't disagree. I love the U.S. more than anybody. But I would say I understand this question so cold. My parents are embarrassed of their accent. And my mom used to not go to parent-teacher conferences Like, they literally are embarrassed of their accent. And so I have a lot of empathy for this question, but I think that that's a crazy thought and you should go for it. Accents a lot of times are an advantage. I would tell you that if you have a British accent, most of my American friends think that you're smarter or more regal. So look, I think that it's a very personal question. I'm very close to it because I've seen my parents be less social, less out there because of their accent. But I don't think the market's going to penalize you for an accent, especially if you have something good to say.
If you're not from an English-speaking country, should you produce content in English to reach a higher number of people, or should you produce content in the native language of your country?
You know, I'm always a fan of the answer of both, so there's always both. If you got the time and the energy and the talent, both. But if you don't, I would say that you need to just figure out what you're trying to accomplish. You know, if you're trying to go global, it's probably a good idea to go English. But if you want to be the biggest wine merchant in Indonesia, maybe you go with the native tongue. And so I also think technology is going to solve this. I think, you know, we're getting closer and closer to a day and age where you're going to press a button and you're going to be dubbed over and you could be everywhere in the world. And so, you know, I think this is very easy for me to answer. And I'm going to try to go philosophical with this so it brings value to everybody. If you understand what you're trying to accomplish, your actions will map to that. So if you're trying to reach as many people as possible, you're going to go with English. If you just want to build the biggest building in town, and I'm using the word biggest building as a slang term for the biggest business, the biggest awareness, the biggest thing you want in your town, and that happens to be in Japan, you may just want to go Japanese. So know what you're trying to accomplish and go backwards on this question. Heck, that's probably the answer to everything.
I am growing my business and looking to include partners for content. What's the best way to recruit them? Money? The promise of exposure?
Yes. Let's go to the next one. Okay, just kidding. The answer is yes. But now I'm really getting into a theme. It's reverse engineering. You go to somebody you want, you like their content, you're like, hey, I would argue you start with promotion because it costs you less, right? So, hey, I'll make you a featured blogger. You could be part of the site. I'll link to all your accounts, to your website. And if they say, you know, people say that to me all the time. And I'm like, get the hell out of here. Well, let me rephrase. In 2006, 7, 8, 9, I said, yep. Because back then, that was what was valuable to me. Now, because I've reached a different level, that's not as easy. Time is a bigger issue for me. And so now I say, get out of here. But if they said, we'll give you $50,000 to blog post on our site, then I would say, when do you want it? And so I think the answer is very simple. You offer both. I would start with the exposure because it costs you less money. Unless, believe it or not, unless you've got tons of money to throw around and you don't want to waste time negotiating back and forth, they're going to say yes to money. The $1 million man in WWF 1980s was one of the great, great philosophers of all time. He said, everybody's got a price. And he's right. So money always works if you can hit their price. But I would go with exposure first.
How much time do you spend creating a single piece of content? Do you focus on video because it's more natural for you?
The answer is I do spend more time on video, meaning not more time on an individual piece of content, but produce a lot more video because it comes very natural to me. I'm very improv. I'm also not winning on my looks. So let me be serious about this. It doesn't take me as long to do an Instagram post because I'm not worried about the lighting. I know that I have bags under my eyes. And those were natural, by the way, before I even didn't sleep a lot. So, you know, I know what I've got going there. On the flip side, if you're a beauty model and you've got to put an Instagram photo, I have empathy towards why you might want to take 22 minutes taking 87 different shots because that's what you're selling. And so I think it comes down to what do you do well? How do you do it? For me, I'm positioned in a way where it's my thoughts, not my pictures, not my art, not my sound. It's my thoughts. So that's simple. And so I don't have to spend a lot of time on content. I never have and I won't. But I do think for a lot of people here, I'm sure Humans of New York and all the other photography platforms out there that use Instagram think long and hard about their shot, take multiple shots, edit it, filter it, tweak it, And so I think it comes down to what you're doing. But if you're lucky enough to be talking about content and just talking about things or just putting out words, then you go there. On the flip side, all my motivational quotes with my pictures in it that I put out that Andrew makes on my team as little status updates for Instagram, I'm sure he's taking a little bit of time. He's a, you know, graphic designer. He cares about the white background on the green lettering and centered in the middle. That's his craft, and he may be spending a little bit more time. So that's the answer.
You've talked before about recycling a tweet, but what about other content, such as a blog post? How often do you pull a piece from the archives to dust it off and republish?
So what we're referring to here with recycling a tweet is Twitter has gotten so noisy that I now will tweet the same thing multiple times in a day because I realize that I'm not reaching even a fraction of my audience, whereas 5 years ago, I would post it and I knew a majority would see it and I didn't need to repost it again and I didn't want to bother the people that saw it the first time again. That's changing with the market. That was something I referred to earlier in the book. So what I would say is I haven't in my history taken a full blog post and reposted it 6 months later because it's evergreen content. On the flip side, I have DJ'd a lot of things, which is taking a portion of a blog post and then socially commentated on top of that, saying 6 months ago I said the following and this is what's happening now. So I think DJing versus recycling, I think editing, reshaping versus recycling is the key here. And by the way, I'm not against it. As a matter of fact, with Medium, which is a platform where people are blogging now, I think it's probably appropriate for a lot of you to take your 10 best blog posts of all time and post them on Medium because it's a different experience. I think as long as you continue to bring value, you can get away with anything. I think if you wrote such a great article that's still evergreen and you want to post it every 6 months, you know, there'll be a percentage of your audience that already saw it and they may be annoyed, but if you're still bringing a lot of people into your network, into your ecosystem, it's providing value.
I spend 10 to 15 hours on image posts I make for my company on social media. They're hand-drawn lettering posts as well as computer-drawn. I get way more likes on my hand-drawn posts than computer-drawn ones. But lettering takes a long time to do, and I don't think I can keep up a daily social media content output. What should I do?
You should do what we should all do, which is weigh the pros and the cons. It's quite simple. Is it worth your time for what you're getting out of it? I would tell you that if you're just getting likes and you can't tie it back into sales or something else that you want to happen, because by the way, this is a great time to rant on this. Guys, social media engagement for the sake of social media engagement is a really bad business. You know, if it's a proxy towards success of getting a TV show, selling stuff, you know, getting a book deal, like if it's a proxy, a gateway drug, God bless. But just being caught up in the game of Rick got 19 likes and I got 17. I'm sad. That means nothing. So, like anything in the world, you need to really break down that hour by hour value prop. Let me break it in very business terms. If the hand-drawn stuff equaled 11 sales of a bottle of wine, and I was putting in 10 hours, I would say, okay, about a net bottle an hour, right? And the computer one was taking an hour, but selling 3 bottles, right? I would say, that's probably better. Now, I may say that in the long term, the hand thing's gonna go more viral and I'll win. So I can look at it at a micro moment and see what the ROI is, but I can also project with my intuition what the long tail is. That's ironically what you have to do here. We always have to value our time, return value in the short term, and what's the upside in the long term.
Hey everyone, this is Sean Duras. Fun fact, I actually am a success story from reading one of Gary's first books, Crush It. I read the book in college, decided to start an online business, that worked out, led to other things. Now I'm crushing it in the social media, doing large campaigns, helping with social strategy, and I actually have one of the most engaged Snapchat accounts in the world. So let's dig into some of these questions. Thanks for having me, Gary. Is it wrong to have my Pinterest account tied to my Twitter account so that when I post on Pinterest, it auto-posts to Twitter?
So this is maybe the most fun question so far in the book. First, Sean Duras, big shout out. I'm really excited about Crush It success stories. As a matter of fact, I am very confident that the Ask Gary Vee book is going to produce an enormous amount of Sean Duras's in the future. So looking forward to hearing from you guys. I answered this on the show. Yes, it is wrong. I am changing my answer. Yep, I hate when this happens, but it's true. And let me tell you why. I'm going to go into very hardcore detail, and this was one of the good reasons you bought the audiobook. And actually, the book that's out right now has a different answer. So that's kind of cool. So I always talk about making native content per platform and not using them for distribution. What's happened is I got too literal on it. What I didn't do a good job of was really explain what I meant by that, which was the following. People were trying to automate everything, right? See what's happening here? Pinterest, and it automatically goes to Twitter. And what I was worried about was that people were creating a scenario where people thought that there was human interaction happening and it was a robot. It was a machine. Also, what happened was Twitter changed. Twitter's changed along the way that allows you to crop pictures properly. So what used to happen on a Pinterest or a Tumblr or an Instagram post is you'd post it to Twitter for distribution, but it would be cut off or the link would be weird and it didn't look good. Recently, many of you have seen, for the first time ever, I've started doing this move with my Instagram account using IFT, which stands for if this, then that. So 3 T's, great little app. You know, you could do something like, if my weather app says it's raining, immediately automatically put into my Google Calendar, grab an umbrella at 7 a.m. Pretty cool, right? Efficiencies. So anyway, I'm doing that now with Instagram, but I've been able to crop my photos to work in Twitter, and there's an IFT link there, which proves that I'm doing the automation. So I would say this, don't be lazy and only use Twitter for distribution, but it's not the worst thing in the world to use Twitter as a distribution tool to bring awareness to your Pinterest. And as a matter of fact, I'm using Twitter more and more as awareness to other things because it's the place I have my biggest audience. However, my least engaged audience by percentage now because Twitter is noisy. So before, and this is a hedge, and now I'm very excited about where Twitter's going, but if Twitter doesn't fix itself over the next 3 to 4 years, it will become MySpace. And so over these next 3 to 4 years, I'm going to siphon as much of my audience out of Twitter and try to get it into Snapchat and Instagram and other places, because that would be really sad that I had 1.2 million people following me on a platform that nobody goes to anymore and all the data's stuck there. So things are changing. Things are always changing.
How can I take my website to the next level by making it go viral and increasing sales and visibility?
Guys, if you're like me, you're starting to pick up on a pattern. People are asking me the same stuff over and over and over again in different ways, and it allows me to keep giving different kind of tweaks and strategies. But the truth is, it comes down to quality, and it comes down to quality of content, and it comes down to quality of biz dev. How good are you at getting awareness for yourself through your content and through distribution channels in other areas that bring awareness to you? There is no going viral. Viral is luck. Viral is a moment in time. Something happened. I don't know what the official definition of viral is these days, but I sure know that it's not calculated and 100% true every time, hence viral, right? You know, how do you actually build a website that's successful, put out great stuff on it, and then, again, let's say that you're reviewing and selling video games. Let me give you an answer. Go to twitter.com/search and search Call of Duty 4. Search Donkey Kong Land. Search Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. See what people are saying and engage with them. Twitter.com/search is an incredible biz dev tool. You can see what people are saying. You're allowed to talk to them on there. It's not private. You know, it's not weird. You jump in and now all of a sudden, like, hey, this guy said Soda Popinski was the hardest guy to beat on Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, just like me. Then they click your profile. Now they're on your website. So you hustle. That's one way. You email all 15 top video game podcasters and you say, hey, I'd love to be on your show. One of them says yes. Remember Wayne? Then you get on. 47,000 people listened to it. 619 liked what you had to say. Maybe 20,000 liked what you said. Depends on what you say. Remember, content is the variable. Now they found out about your website, right? Maybe you got a couple bucks and you buy Facebook ads against all fans of PlayStation 3 and you put out some of your content and they see you that way. Guys, there's a million ways to biz dev. You go to all the forums and there's 1,000 of them about video games and you create an account and you become part of the community. You don't go on and spam everyone and say, come check out my site. You start just debating Zelda's best version and you become part of the community. You create content. And by the way, if you're exhausted from everything I said, I've left out 97 other tactics and it's going to take years for this to work. That's how.
I posted a video on Facebook that got 2,700 views and 35 shares in one day. It took 1 year for me to get that same number of views on YouTube. Should I focus on creating videos for Facebook exclusively?
This is tough. The answer is no if you have the time, yes if you're very, very, very tight on time, but yes for only a period of time. Meaning, YouTube had those same things going on that Facebook did for you in 2006, 7, and 8. The problem is, so many people went on, supply and demand. Facebook, for you at the time you asked that question, I bet you if you posted that same video today, you'd get less, because Facebook video, when you asked this question, I recall, because I was hot on Facebook video and answering all the questions, was also a land grab. Now it's got a supply and demand problem. Maybe there's a 15-second Instagram video that you can do, and then that becomes a supply and demand problem. So, first of all, I'm always bullish on new emerging platforms at scale, where you can win, so that's why maybe yes on Facebook. On the flip side, YouTube is a monster. And don't forget, even though you might get 319 views on a YouTube video, all it takes is the one right view to change the course of your career or your opportunities. So I would not go anywhere exclusively in a world of Facebook and YouTube, because those are the two bohemian sites. It's like, should I only go on Letterman and Leno? If, well, they wouldn't let you, but if they both allowed you to go on, you would have went on both. That's how I think about Facebook and YouTube. They are both very, very important, and you may ebb and flow in popularity on each platform, but there's so much attention on both that you've got to take them both seriously.
Since you're such a fan of Facebook videos, do you plan on embedding them on your own website instead of your YouTube videos? And is it more beneficial to do so if you're not monetizing?
That's a great question. The answer is Facebook, and I'm surprised, this question was probably asked a year ago on the show. Facebook's video embeds are still not great, still not rolling. The truth is, I'm embedding YouTube videos still on my website, though at the time I probably would have thought a year later I'd probably do more Facebook. I think at the end of the day, YouTube still has an advantage of like a very clean, easier embed than Facebook does right now. Projecting to a day when Facebook is at that same place, if Facebook's share functionality on its embed video is very effective, I will go there, because that means somebody watching my video has a chance of bringing more people into my network by sharing it. And so that would be the key decision that I would go on, which is, are people sharing from your website embed into a Facebook ecosystem? If it's happening, I'm definitely going to go to Facebook.
You say you don't consume much media, but isn't it kind of necessary in order to put out relevant, current content?
No, and that's truth. Let me explain. I think the reason I'm putting out relevant and current content, and the numbers speak for themselves, is because I'm paying attention to the community, not to other content around the world. What I mean by that is, what you're referring to and what most people ask me is, aren't you seeing what other people are doing? Can't you pick up stuff from them? And the answer is yes, if that's how you learn. That's not how I learn. As a matter of fact, I learn by watching how people respond to my stuff, and it's kind of like a self-circling thing. I put out content, I see what they do, I adjust to it. I consume my community, their actions, people that have 8 followers, 22 followers. I'm trying to figure out what my audience cares about. I'm not worried what Seth Godin or Guy Kawasaki or Jason Fried or Tim Ferriss are doing, because they're doing their thing. And as a matter of fact, I think one of the biggest reasons a lot of people are not becoming important voices in technology, media, business, social networks, is because they're so affected by everybody else that they consume, they just become me too's. Right? And so my big advantage actually is my lack of reading books and my complete zero of following other people actually creates a scenario where I think the reason I've popped is because I'm fresh. It's because I'm naive. It's because I have different ways to say the same thing. People love my quotes because I'm not smart enough to have heard the original version of the quote, and I'm just making up my own version. There's a freshness. There's an original aspect to what I do, because maybe I'm influenced by the world. I think I'm influenced by black stand-up comedians in my speaking style, right? There's influences, but I've been able to be an original because I don't spend 4 hours a day listening to everybody else's podcast and reading 17 blog posts and their newsletters. And that's something a lot of you need to think about.
Is Pinterest really such a good marketing tool? And how could a small business like a restaurant use it well?
The answer is yes. Pinterest is a good marketing tool. As a matter of fact, go to Google right now and type in Pinterest success stories, and you will read about thousands of people that have made tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and millions of dollars on the backbone of Pinterest, because hundreds of millions of people use it, and thus it's a good marketing tool. Is it a good marketing tool for you is the question that you and everybody else who's listening really wants to know. Let's get into the example, the restaurants. Look, Can they put beautiful pictures of food? Sure, but that works even better on Instagram than it does on Pinterest. What I think you need to think about is, look, first and foremost, it is a very heavy female demo right now on Pinterest. So one of the things that I think is great is actually finding out how many of your patrons of your restaurant are actually on Pinterest. Let me explain. Imagine you walk into a restaurant and at the hostess, as soon as you walk in, there's a huge sign, not subtle, not a little card, the half-assed version that all of you do by putting a little Facebook and Twitter logo in the window of your store, but you're really half-assing it. No, I mean a big-ass sign that says, "Are you on Pinterest?" Now people are curious. Now they ask the person in the front of your restaurant, because you hired somebody for $13 an hour that actually knows about Pinterest. So remember that part, because don't just rely on your host or hostess, because they may not know. And they say, "Hey, I'm on Pinterest. What does this mean?" "Oh, ma'am, we're doing something really interesting. We're offering free desserts to anybody that's on Pinterest if they post a picture and put it on their Pinterest. And if you don't like it, say you don't. But if you do, you do." Now, all of a sudden, imagine this is happening, and who doesn't want free dessert for a quick snap on their iPhone, right? Now all of a sudden, first person comes, they only have 50 followers on Pinterest. There's only 50 other women that follow that person, but it's a woman that lives in a small town of a restaurant, and the 50 people that happen to follow that woman are the other 50 moms in that high school that also live in that area. Now they say the chocolate is delicious. "Oh, I'd never really been to Sal's Pizzeria before, and now they're coming." Or what about the Hail Mary? Because you got 90, 100, 500 people that had 30 and 40 and 50 people. But let's just say that the person that lives in town is the leading yarn expert on Pinterest with 78,000 people that follow her Pinterest board. And she snaps something around your cinnamon sticks and say it's delicious. And now you got 492 people coming to your restaurant because some people from 22 miles away decided to come. My friends, this is business. It works. It just, you have to be original. You have to be aggressive. You have to come up with stuff that matters. So Pinterest can be used by you by putting out photos, but you can also leverage people's communities. It just takes a little bit of creativity. It takes a commitment. It takes spending $400 on a nice sign on Pinterest. It takes investing $13 into a person. Wait a minute. Let me get this straight, Sal. You hired some kid from the local high school that knows about Pinterest, $13 an hour, to stand in the front of your restaurant? That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Why would a restaurant need to pay somebody $13? It's the same argument everybody told my dad of allowing his punk kid to buy a website. The internet was a fad, right? Right, old friends from New Jersey? The internet was a fad, wasn't it?
What kind of headlines attract you on social media?
Look, I think for me, the kind of headlines that excite me are things like Jets sign new linebacker, right? Or wine business explodes in Japan. Or, former WWF wrestler Hillbilly Jim to be in New York this weekend. They're things that matter to me. And so I think one of the great things about what Facebook has done is they've created so much data that we can really target these kind of headlines to individuals. So first and foremost, recognize we now live in a world where you can do that around your business. The other thing that I think is super interesting is the BuzzFeedification, if that's a word I can anoint, of our society. I think over the last 5 to 7 years, mainly the last 2 to 3 years, we've all become aware of these headlines. 19 good-looking girls that live around the corner, right? Or 7 beers that you should drink before you die. Or the 63 best cars anybody's ever driven. That's clearly worked. Now, just like I talk about a lot, it's market dynamics. I can tell you from fact, from a lot of testing, those kind of headlines aren't working as much anymore because that's what we used to get people, and now it's not working anymore. So there's going to be different kinds of headlines that emerge. One of the new things I'm doing is very utilitarian headlines. And this may sound silly, believe it or not, it's countercultural right now, which is things like this individual tactic works on Facebook. It's just a sentence, right? Taking 3 pictures at a time works on Facebook, right? Pictures that have red in them on Instagram work better. Just a very direct punch to you, and people are really responding to that because they're kind of tired of the hyperbole of the 37 kittens that are the cutest in the world. So now I'm going the other way and being very direct, and I'm seeing very good early results. So on your next blog post or social media headlines, try that out.
I know you're not big on automation, but it's a reality. How do you decide what and when to automate, and what's your take on marketing automation software? You're an advisor at HubSpot. Thoughts on that space?
Let me use this as a clarity, and I did this a little bit earlier in the book, but I'm going to keep pounding this home. I do think that automation is a reality. I'm not against automation. I love automation. I don't like when automation is trying to trick the other person on the other end to make it feel like that's a human interaction. That's it. That's the flag in the ground. Let me give you an example. Early email marketing. I was there. Somewhere along the line, in very early 2000s, somebody was smart and figured out, wait a minute, what if we put the person's name in the email? Instead of saying, here's the wine deal, it would say, hey, Ben, comma, here's the wine deal. The problem was they cared about the automation more than the human aspect, meaning at that point, the technology boom of the early internet, that had never happened before. So the only time you ever saw, hey, Ben, was when a human being actually typed it. The problem was so many of those early executions had, hey, Ben, in a different font, in a different color, in a different style, and you started realizing, oh, they're just trying to game me, and you started not liking that service. I don't like when people are trying to automate human interaction. For example, when the Boston Marathon massacre happened, the amount of friends and businesses that I saw tweeting as the country was beginning to really mourn what just had happened about promoting their book, as a matter of fact, one friend, to buy their new cell phone. These were scheduled tweets, right? And the automation made them look so crass, so out of touch, and they damaged their brand. There was a thing that happened on 9/11 with AT&T that really hurt them. Like, literally, there was multiple people in my office that gave up their AT&T subscription because of that. It's when automation goes bad. The Patriots, you know, I like to pick on them. They did a thing where you could put the name, your name on the back of a jersey, but then people started putting in really raw things, and that kind of was hurtful. Let me give you another example of why I'm concerned about this. You know how you go to a conference and everybody's networking? And you know the guy that just runs around and hands his business card to everybody? He doesn't even look you in the eye. He doesn't even say hello. It's just about him getting it off. It's really an automated kind of execution. Or the person that gives the same presentation every time without reading the context of the room. Non-human things are bad, especially when the person expects it to be a human interaction. And so automation is fine, and I'm super comfortable with it. But if you're trying to create scale around something that's not scalable, which is human interaction, you will create a vulnerability.
How do you think overly edited photos and text overlays affect the authenticity of Instagram posts?
You know, I think this falls into the romantic point of view and the quality point of view. Let me explain. Look, I think quality is in the eye of the beholder, and I think if you're a photographer or somebody that loves art, you see this beautiful photo, and then over it says, buy this portrait in like some crappy font, you're like, that got ruined, right? But then there's also like the point and the intent. So I believe this is truly a very subjective kind of call. For me, I'm a businessman, right? So when I see a good copy right hook on top of a pretty picture, I'm like, yeah, get it, sell that stuff. But I recognize that my artist friends are like, you've ruined America, Gary. You've ruined the art. And I think because Instagram specifically started as a very photographer, artistic place, I have empathy for why people feel like now it's being ruined by these kind of edits. I just know that that's what always happens. I mean, just the way it is. So that's kind of how I see it.
What advice would you give people who want to grow their companies but don't have your personality and have a hard time meeting people?
Well, first I would take a step back and let everybody understand that there are millions of hardcore introverts and antisocial or awkwardly social individuals building enormous businesses. I met a gentleman a couple weeks ago who built an $800 million business and barely could look at my eye the entire time. I would say to bet on your strengths. If you're a hardcore data nerd and not the greatest, you know, life of the party, then don't go build a party experience business. Go build a math business. So first and foremost, we have to ground ourselves in understanding that truth. For me, I bet on my strengths, my personality, my leadership, my putting out content. But this is a classic example of, you know, people looking at me and saying, that's how I have to do it versus figuring out how they have to do it for themselves. I would say build something that allows people to come to you, you know, instead of you going to them. I'm good at me going to them. You might be good at them coming to you. And so you just have to bet on your strengths and recognize there's a million ways to win this game. It just comes down to you executing you.
Hey, I'm Zach Moy. I'm Gary's designer. What's the best way for a real estate agent to gain buyer's trust on Twitter?
Real Estate. Boy, do I love you guys. Big shout out to all the real, you know, it's funny, a lot of you are driving around right now, so big shout out to all of you guys. One of the early groups that attacked Twitter in 2008, 9, and 10, mainly because I think the housing crisis happened and a lot of people are like, all right, I'm going to go be a social media expert. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for real estate agents to gain trust, and I think it comes by doing trustworthy things. So first and foremost, I think you've got to put out a lot of content. And let me throw you for a curveball. This is my favorite example. I believe if you're a real estate agent and you know the area that you sell in, that you should become the authority of the area. Meaning, what if on Twitter you put out 30-second videos of interviewing people in town that were merchants, educators, parts of the community? For example, a lot of real estate agents in the Millburn Short Hills area of New Jersey sell the fact that Wine Library is in town as a selling hook, right? It'd be really cool if one of them came to me and said, can I talk about Springfield or Millburn or Short Hills for 30 seconds? And they used that in their marketing. I believe the biggest white space in real estate is to become the expert and the media company around the area that you sell in. That is building trust because you're giving them other content besides what we all think as humans, which is, you're just trying to make a commission on me on this house sale, and that's that. You're not working my best interest, you're working at your best interest. And so by you putting in a lot of work, educating me on the school system, interviewing the superintendent, speaking to Sal's Pizza Shop, who's been there for 42 years, Sal, how's the area changed? A lot. You know, those kind of things I think are really clever. And so that's one hardcore way. Now we're saying specifically on Twitter, here's another. I think an amazing jab, using my terminology, is somebody tweeting out that they're looking for a house. A lot of people on Saturday mornings, I've done this work, search on twitter.com/search right now, going to an open house. Search that. Go into twitter.com/search on the internet and type in the search bar, in quotes, going to an open house. You can actually make your search only 10, 20, 30 miles in radius too. If you actually, as a real estate agent, watched people who tweeted that, and then replied, good luck, have a great time, not you should use me, no, not, hey, have you checked out this opening listing, but the first move was a jab, hey, you picked a great town, I've been selling homes in Cranford, New Jersey for 40 years, have fun, make sure you stop by Sal's Pizza, right? Now all of a sudden, you've brought value, right? You're not just trying to go in for the close. So there's a ton of little tactics like I just described that can make you do it, but if you've noticed, both of those take work.
Do you think brands need to be represented across all social platforms or just the most popular ones?
I think it really comes down to your business. I mean, look, I think any platform that has potential to return business for you is a worthwhile thing. I also think about resources. If you're a one or two person team, if you and your husband are running a business where you're producing handmade ties in your kitchen and you don't have unlimited hours to market your business, you may just want to stick to Facebook. I get it. I'm not mad at you. But to not recognize that Snapchat has 150 million users or 400, 500, where's Instagram now? I mean, these are massive platforms with customers. I mean, if you actually thought about social networks like storefronts, would you say, is it okay to have one store or do you want 10 stores? I mean, the answer is, what's your ambition? What's your talent? What's your North Star? So I think that one thing that people should do is after a year and a half of doing it every day, if you're not getting value from a platform, then you can let it go. That I respect. But to not do Instagram and watch, again, I'm picking on it, Netflix or play Call of Duty while running a business, that's a mistake. What I'm worried about is I'm giving you permission not to hustle and add another social network that can do business for you in lieu of other things. So there is no right answer to this other than to not be on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat or Pinterest is only leaving upside on the table, right? And so if you've got the bandwidth, you need to be there.